From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, Waukesha-based Discover Magazine rates the top science stories of 2013, big and small.
This year's little things are going to be next year's or next 10 years of, Nobel Prize winners or game changers for the way we look at technology or our health or our own evolution as a species.
Some book ideas for your holiday gift list this year, including one that has successfully made the transition from a blog.
And sometimes it translates well into a book, but most of the time not. This is fantastic. This is as good, if not better, than some of the blog posts that he has.
And writer Michael Perry stops by to share the story of his new collection of essays, and we'll hear one of them as well. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Scientists yesterday announced they've discovered evidence that Mars was once home to a giant freshwater lake that could have supported life. That's just the latest revelation since the Curiosity rover touched down on Mars last year. But how does that news compare with all the other developments on the scientific front in 2013? The scientific magazine Discover has covered many science advances, breakthroughs, and controversies over the past 12 months. And in the latest issue, the Waukesha-based publication looks back at the top 100 from the year. We would be here for a while if we tried to recap all 100 of them, so instead we invited editor Steve George to join us in the studio to give us some insight into the top five anyway. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Before we get to the list itself, give us some insight into how you decided on it. We're going to hear the top five, but you've actually compiled a top 100 list.
Yes. So the editors select the top 100 based on oftentimes they're based on things that, they're just in the news. Everyone knows about them. Everyone has heard about them. And of course, we cover those. But we also try to look at the little things that have, far reaching, sometimes mind blowing implications. And sometimes just to take a second look at things that are in the news and to offer a little perspective. So it's a nice mix of things. It's not always sort of the top of mind things that everyone knows about, but that would come and go in the course of a year that folks might overlook.
And as I look at the list, some of these are kind of big picture items and some of them are singular development kinds of items.
Yeah, absolutely. We really tried to cover the spread and especially to look at, this year's little things are going to be next year's or next 10 years of, Nobel Prize winners or game changers for the way we look at technology or our health or our own evolution as a species.
Well, so let's get right to it. Starting with number five, stem cell work has been going on for quite some time. So what were the breakthroughs of the past 12 months that led you to include it so highly on your list?
Well, it's one of those things where every year it seems that there's new and amazing stuff going on with stem cells. And we tried to look at a few things that really raise the bar. For me, one of the breakthroughs that I found most compelling and that we included was out of Japan this year. And cell biologists at Yokohama City University were able to take stem cells from human skin, from your skin or mine, and they were able to reprogram it to an earlier state, in a state where it could be morphed into virtually any type of cell in the body. And from these cells, the researchers were able to generate liver buds, these little mini livers, five millimeters a piece that functioned. They transplanted them into mice and they worked just like livers do. They were filtering sugars and drugs and they worked. So the next step is obviously to get to a point where this can be done in humans. I mean, the liver donor or the liver transplant waiting list is thousands of names long, and it's definitely a huge problem in Japan. I mean, it's a huge problem worldwide, but this is the first small step, literally 5 millimeters, to a point where this could be used in humans who have liver failure. It could be the building blocks to doing this with other types of organs, and I just find that mind-blowing that from this little piece of a skin cell sample that you can save somebody's life.
And And is the thought that this would someday replace the liver that has failed, or would it just serve as something that could that could keep someone alive until a liver transplant is available?
Well, I think it's probably both. To actually use these buds to keep somebody alive and functioning indefinitely, you'd need to have an infusion of tens of thousands. But it certainly is promising in that you could foresee them being able to grow bigger. So they're not mini livers; they're actual functioning livers that could take the place of the failed organ.
Well, speaking of big picture, where would you put the needle on the continuum, to mix a metaphor? This all kind of started with Dolly the sheep 17 years ago. How far are we from that point to the point where stem cell therapy is common practice?
Well, it's a good question. And obviously there's still quite a bit of, there are ethical and even in some cases religious concerns. I think obviously for this type of research, they're not using embryos, or they're regressing an actual skin cell sample to an embryonic state. But it's the research itself is still very embryonic. But I mean, for something like this, I think it's 10 years away. And to me, that's amazing. 10 years is no time at all when you think about it. So I think it's up and coming.
So that was number five. Number four struck me because at one level, it doesn't necessarily seem like a science story. Why is privacy on the list, and how do you frame the issue?
Well, obviously, Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who leaked this information about the NSA surveillance program, that was one of the biggest stories anywhere, in or out of the world of science. For us, part of our coverage includes technology and the way it affects our lives. And for us, the interesting thing here was PRISM, which is the name for the data surveillance program that that gathers internet communications from both open sources and private companies. And what was compelling to us was, and I think this is often overlooked, was that this system is a huge data miner, and it focuses largely on metadata, the who, what, when, where of our communications and transactions online, which seems like very innocuous stuff that we don't think twice about. But technology and data mining has grown to a point where this kind of metadata is in essence content. And the way that it can be tracked has, I think, profound implications not only for our sense of what privacy and private information is, but also for the future development of online communications and services and the technology we use to access it or protect it. So I think as a technology story, it has huge implications and certainly was something that we wanted to address.
And would you contend that the way either we get ourselves out of this situation or the way the situation evolves, is it a science story or is it a policy story?
Well, I think it's both. And I think for us, we look more at the science and the technology that may arise from policy. We try not to have a political position about it. But obviously, this happened. There's this system that's in place that obviously is the result of a great deal of technology and research. And for us, that's interesting, especially for how it's going to inform the future of the technology that we use to stay connected and do our business online.
Number three is also kind of at the nexus of science and policy. We're talking climate change. What was the significant development that placed it at number three for you?
Well, so this is one of those stories that I think the mainstream media looked for. It made quite a splash in the spring, which was basically the fact that carbon dioxide, which is the greenhouse gas that contributes most to global warming, had reached a concentration of 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. And this was a level that hadn't been seen in thousands of years. And it was touted in the media when the story broke as this long-feared milestone. And we selected one because, of course, global warming is important. And no one's saying that going to 400 parts per million is not important. But from a climatologist standpoint, it's a milestone on the highway. They knew this was going to happen. And what was not widely covered at the time was the fact that that particular reading from that particular sensor actually dipped down, and it was in Hawaii, which was in the northern hemisphere, where there are the higher concentrations of CO2. And as the growing season came about and plants were greening up more, the levels actually dropped as the plants absorbed more CO2. So it was one of those instances where this so-called milestone, I think we wanted to offer that perspective of, it's it's not the end times, and we wanted to offer that perspective. Now, I mean, if you're talking about end times, if it was 800 parts per million, that'd probably be number one. And, you know, there'd be no ice on land. The oceans would be up about 250 feet. And apart from anything else, my in-laws would lose their condo in Florida. And that would be a big deal, both personally and obviously professionally. So I think it was important to address this sort of mainstream news, science story, an environmental issue, and just give it a little bit of perspective without diminishing the fact that it's still obviously a great issue that we need to be concerned about.
And this sort of points at it as somewhere in between a tangible and a symbolic milestone.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Back to medicine for number two. We talked stem cells a few minutes ago. Now let's talk about genetics. Hardly a week goes by when we don't report on something having to do with the human genome. So what did you see as the key storyline for 2013?
For us, the event that I felt was the most interesting and compelling and could have the furthest reaching implications was actually the Supreme Court ruling in June that essentially invalidates a huge number of DNA patents held by biotechnology companies. And basically what the ruling did was said that naturally occurring DNA sequences cannot be patented. It's not enough to discover it to secure the patent. It has to be invented or modified in such a way that it could not possibly be naturally occurring. And I think the locus for this issue was that the ruling broke a virtual monopoly on certain kinds of genetic testing for mutations in genes that contribute to breast and ovarian cancer. And so these tests, the cost for these tests, which was controlled by the company, cost thousands. And it was something that made it very hard for people who might be suffering with this to afford these tests. And more far-reaching, I think, is the fact that researchers are reluctant to work with so-called patented genes. And so scientists were shying away from doing important work involving these patented genes. And so by invalidating those patents, I think that, well, one, there were some immediate effects. I mean, the day that the ruling was announced, you had competing genetic companies offering a much more affordable form of these tests. And I think further reaching is that you will see more and more researchers obviously doing work with these genes that were once protected by patent and now are not. So I think that's a huge development, and it happened this year.
So to recap, numbers 5 through 2 of the top science stories of the year have been stem cell work, privacy concerns, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, and changes in the way human genetic research is playing out. What is your top science story of the year?
Well, for there, we have to actually leave the Earth. For us, it was focused on Mars and the Curiosity rover. Now, you might say, okay, well, Curiosity landed in 2012, so why is that a year in science moment, let alone your biggest year in science moment for 2013? Well, I look at when Curiosity landed on Mars in 2012 as, you know, it showed up for work. That's great. 2013 is where Curiosity really delivered the goods. And I think one of the most profound things was that obviously it was on the ground and its onboard instruments were able to sample the soil of Mars and identify traces of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, basically all of the components that you need to sustain life. So it was the most compelling proof that Mars was indeed once able to sustain life. And so that, to me, that was tremendous. And obviously, Curiosity's done quite a bit more. It's done quite a bit of research to basically help us get to a point where we can send a manned mission to Mars, did some tests on radiation levels there, made some important findings that would affect how we would create better shielding for astronauts as they're heading to the red planet. I could go on for way more time than we have. So the fact that 2013 was really Curiosity's year to shine, we felt was the most profound and compelling thing. Plus, I like that little rover. It's not even that little. It's about the size of a Mini Cooper. But to me, it's just fascinating that it's there now doing the work. It's heading on to its next destination.
Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. You're the editor-in-chief of Discover. What was number 94?
94. Oh, my Lord. Now I've got to run to the book. Now, you know, it's funny. When you have 100, we at the time that we were putting it out, we were pretty good at knowing where most things fell in the lineup. So number 94 was a story that's basically about the sensation of the itch. And once just believed to be a milder version of pain, in fact, it is its own separate sensation involving completely separate neural circuitry. And it sounds like a little thing, but if you've ever had an itch, and I got to tell you, this time of year, my skin gets pretty dry. I got to say, that's cool to know. And so understanding that it's a different pathway helps researchers develop new ways to treat it and target it more directly. And so maybe itchy skin will be a thing of the past one day.
A good case of one of those things that seems kind of lighthearted, but actually there's really something to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So itch research number 94, and we'll have a link to much more about all of these things from our website. Steve George, thanks so much.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Steve George is editor-in-chief at Discover Magazine, the national magazine on science and science news. He's published by Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing Company. Discover's top 100 science stories of 2013 are counted down in the January-February issue, which is just coming out. There is a link to more from the magazine at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a quick break now, and then a Northwoods man's view of snow in southeastern Wisconsin. It might surprise you, actually. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The first major snowfall of the year has provided more than a few challenges for Milwaukeeans. There was Sunday morning's shoveling, then Sunday afternoon's shoveling, and of course, Sunday evening's shoveling. And if you didn't get around to Sunday evening's shoveling, there was Monday morning's shoveling. And if that weren't enough, the wind started whipping around the piles of snow soon after it stopped falling. Still, you would think the residents of Wisconsin's North Woods, who are used to copious amounts of snowfall, might look with some amusement at our relatively modest snow depth in these parts. Not so Lake Effect essayist George Burdies.
Up here in the woods, we pretty much take snowstorms for granted. Oh, sure, we cuss and sweat and fret as we struggle with shovels and snowblowers and digging ourselves out of white caves. But then, in a periodic bravado, and with our big city cousins in mind, we strut the thought that those urban folks don't even come close to matching us when it comes to snow. Yes, yes, it's good to be a survivor, a doer of hard challenges. We up northers deserve to snap our suspenders over whittling down a big pile of snow. But I believe it's a mistake to regard our big city friends as wimps when mean winter storms hammer places like Milwaukee or Chicago. I base my plea on the experience of having been in Milwaukee during that fateful period of last February when a rip snorter of a storm dumped 12-plus inches of snow and then whipped it into wind-driven swirling dunes that paralyzed the city. It's an amazing thing to see a busy, dizzy city come to a cold stop. It was so bad that city buses were pulled off the streets early. Schools were already closed in anticipation. Stores and offices quickly followed suit, shutting their doors early. People by the thousands began the long and dangerous trek home on clogged, icy streets and expressways that were anything but express. Out of the sprawl and amid its towering office buildings, however, symbols emerge from the driven snow, and what they say silently and without boasting is, "Hey, you guys up in the woods, we're just as tough as you are." That fact was embodied in one small but gigantic example I witnessed about noon on the storm's second day at the intersection on the northern edge of downtown. I had ventured out to a nearby grocery. To get there, I had to climb, slush through, maneuver around mounds of snow, unavoidably pushed into those crossing points by plows, making the road safer for cars but far more challenging for walkers. As I approached that virtually impassable crosswalk, I came on a young woman standing at the edge of a towering pile of snow, trying to decide how best to confront it, to get to the other side. However, she brought with her an even greater obstacle that doubled the challenge. She was a youngish, small woman, early 20s, I'd guess, and no more than 5 feet tall. However, her body was twisted and gnarled by some unknown disease or accident. She carried a cane. I stood silently a few feet behind her, ready to help if needed, but hesitant to intrude on her dignity and gutsy independence. She started by putting one foot forward into a deep slush pile, nearly to the top of her boots. She used the cane to probe the target of her next step. Wavering as much by fear as wind, she made the second step, tottered, and then ever so slowly, the next step and the next that finally put her out onto the roadway. I heaved a sigh of relief and followed. After we were both out of the snowy morass, she stopped and pondered her next move. It was then she peered back at me and uttered what was assuredly the prize-winning understatement of the year. "Not easy walking out here." What that brave, young, handicapped, but determined urban citizen of Milwaukee proved so forcefully is that we folks up here in the woods have nothing over our big city cousins when it comes to confronting snowstorms. One thing for sure, winter snowstorms are not for wimps.
Essayist George Birdie spends part of the year in the temperate climes of Milwaukee and the warmer months in the North Woods. Many of his essays originally ran in a weekly series on WXPR in Rhinelander. There is a link to the full collection at his blog, East of Eagle River, and you'll find a link to it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. On a day you're sucked in by snow, it's always nice to have a good book to spend some time with. Books & Company's Lisa Bedoin joins us after a break with some books that might have slipped under your radar. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you have readers on your holiday shopping lists, and it's probably a fair bet there might be one or two of them at the least, it can be a challenge to find something they might like that they have not already read. Fortunately, this morning we have the services of Lisa Bedoin, proprietor of Books & Company in Oconomowoc, who brings with her some noteworthy titles that aren't necessarily on the bestseller list, but might just fit the bill for you or a loved one. Lisa Bedoin, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mitch. It's good to be back.
Well, it's great to see you again, and happy holidays. Like you did about this time last year, you have brought along a stack, a really big stack of books with you that are pretty interesting looking. Not just interesting in terms of what they're about, but really they are interesting looking books and some unique titles with some pretty unique concepts behind them. Let's wade right in to start with a book called Wunderkammer.
It's by Todd Williams and Billy Seen, and they're both architects. And the concept behind this was a cabinet of curiosities. And they did their entry into the Venice Biennial were these boxes that they sent to various designers and architects. And the book itself is like a curiosity cabinet.
Right,
you're not real sure.
Have no idea what it's about.
Yeah, and it's it's a small trim. It itself looks like a little small box, and it is full of photographs and the whole concept behind, and it's just fascinating. It's one of those books that only works well as a book, and it is just, it's beautiful, it's interesting, it's curious, and you want to keep looking.
And so the idea is they sent these boxes to designers and architects and said, do what you want with them and put what you want inside them?
Exactly. The two architects who conceived of the project both collect odd objects themselves. And then they were thinking about their houses, how houses and buildings are boxes that hold curiosities, hold people, hold stories. So they reached out to have other artists do the same with these boxes. So they're filled with lots of different things.
Yeah. And this is the kind of thing that it's not a read from cover to cover kind of enterprise. It's maybe not the size of a coffee table book, but you could definitely leave it out and pick it up and get something out of it and probably go back to the same page a day later and reconsider what you just saw.
Exactly. And it really is. It's a curiosity. You're not quite sure where it's going to take you. It's a joy.
It's Wunderkammer by Todd Williams and Billy Teen. And Lisa Bedoin is with us and has another really interesting concept for a book. This is a book. It's a photography book called Humans of New York.
And I'm not a big fan of blogs to books. Brandon Stanton started a blog called Humans of New York. And, you know, it gets reposted on Facebook all the time and you get these. And sometimes it translates well into a book, but most of the time not. This is fantastic. This is as good, if not better, than some of the blog posts that he has. It's the perfect gift for teenagers and young college students. And my boys who are in high school spent hours just looking at the photographs. It is it's a fantastic collection of humanity.
And the idea is this photographer, Brandon Stanton, decided he was going to do kind of a photographic census of New York. For people who haven't seen the blog, this is what he does. A little of this, a little of that, and some really kind of clever captions.
It is. And he gets, you know, he's not intrusive. And yet you do sort of feel like you get to eavesdrop on, you know, visually eavesdrop on the streets of New York. And he takes their photograph and asks them to tell him their story. And they're brief and they're long. And, you know, it's just fascinating.
Well, and, you know, it's really the kind of thing that we all kind of do. If you're, you know, just riding in a car or the bus and you're looking at the people outside or you're walking across the street and you see somebody waiting on the opposite side of the street, you wonder, you know, what's their story?
Yeah. And it is. It's he makes the extraordinary normal and the normal extraordinary. It's just a good book to browse through.
And again, another one that you can just leave out and pick it up and open it. And you know, the cliche, a picture is worth a thousand words is really true in this case.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's Humans of New York. Brandon Stanton is the photographer. There's another book that I've seen a fair amount about online, but really the book itself, online does not do it justice. You kind of have to have this thing in your hand. This is called Art Made from Books, Altered, Sculpted, Carved, Transformed, and it is really, you know, something to have in your hand.
It is. It's an object of art in of itself. The binding has been exposed on the side, and it is just gorgeous. You want to have it in your hands. It doesn't work well online. And it's just a collection of artist books that have, you know, been transformed.
They've taken books and they've turned them into kind of sculpture or art objects.
And that's probably one of the hardest things to do. I had a class in college, a book arts class in college, and one of the first projects was to alter a book. And we hold books to be so sacred. It's really hard to cut them and alter them and change the pages. And yet it's so freeing to see them in a different form and see them transformed into another way of telling a story.
And this is another way besides just stacking them up in your next to your nightstand.
Yes. And it's, you know, it's another way to give them a new life and a new story.
We should mention the people that put this book together, Laura Hayenga, Brian Detmer, and Allison Kuhn. And there are just remarkable images of what artists have done with books inside. It's Is it? Would you technically call that? Is that a paperback? Is it a hardcover? It's kind of.
Well, it's paper over board is what we technically call it. So it's more of a hardcover than a paperback, and the Coptic binding is exposed. Wisconsin has a really strong tradition in the book arts, and so this is sort of a nice tie into that.
That is art made from books, altered, sculpted, carved, and transformed. Now for something a little different, although you could definitely call a picture book art in its own way, but a really charming new picture book you brought with you called Once Upon a Memory.
And one of my favorite lines in it is, "Does a book remember it was once a word?" And that is sort of the catch of the whole story. Does a bird remember it was once a feather? Or a flock, remember, it was once a feather. And the illustrations are tender, very sweet, very gentle. And the language, it's just perfect. Does a garden remember it was once a pea? It's just very simple concept.
Simple concept, but on the other hand, as you were describing it before we started recording, it's another one of those picture books that adults really get something out of.
And picture books can take a really complex, big idea and bring it down to such a simple way, and it hits home.
And the drawings are really charming. These are the drawings of Renata Luska. The text is by Nina Layden. It's called Once Upon a Memory, and this is a brand new book. Is that right?
Yep. It just came out last week.
So we might think of children's books as their own form of poetry, but we have a real live poet whose work you have brought with you, a fairly well-known poet, in fact. This is Wendell Berry.
And his collection, The Mad Farmer Poems, is just out in paperback. It's been several years that it came out in hardcover, beautiful, oversized hardcover, but it wasn't a book that you could carry around with you. And these are poems that you should carry around with you. And I'm a big advocate for slipping poetry books into stockings and slipping poetry books in as extra gifts. I think they're something to, when you want a moment to change perspective, you can pick up a book of poetry, read a poem, and it can just alter your mood. It can open up the world, and it could be the right thing at the right time.
What can you tell us about the Mad Farmer Poems?
The Mad Farmer Poems, he really gets to that a little bit of orneriness, the pause that we need to look at the things around us, to stop and not take it all for granted, and just to stop and see the world and appreciate the hard work of the farmers, which is something we, with all the thought towards where our food comes from, I think these are good poems to bring us back to that core and to question.
And to be certain, you can get a big hardcover edition of this. But this is a nice slim 64-page volume that you really could slip in your back pocket.
And you should slip it into your back pocket.
Which is another argument against the e-reader, because if you do that, you're likely to break it.
Exactly.
There's another book you brought with you, which you most definitely cannot slip into your back pocket. But that's okay, because it is something that you definitely want in front of you. This is a book of photographs. It's called Schlitz Brewing Art.
Yes, Paul Bylis, the artist, or the photographer and author of the book, was able to photograph the Schlitz Brewery before it was torn down. And he did a book called Pabst, which is similar. But in this book, he really was able to delve more into the history of Schlitz Brewing and Milwaukee. It is fascinating, with pictures of artifacts and photographs of the building after it had been left vacant for so many years.
Right. There are lots of objects that had been still sitting in this brewery. And, it's this kind of elegant decline that you see, things that were meant to have something done with had just been sitting there for years.
Yeah. And the photographs are beautiful. The introduction is by Peter Eline, and the bits of history make it a little more in-depth than the Pabst book was.
And it is not just a book. It is also a book and CD.
Yeah, there are interviews from former Pabst employees and songs written about Schlitz by local musicians and recorded.
This is just another one of those, first of all, only in Milwaukee. This is a unique Milwaukee institution and, sort of a great way to commemorate local history.
Exactly.
So that is Schlitz Brewing Art, Paul Bylis. And finally, you have one. We're going to transition nicely from our interview to the next interview. But tell us a little bit about Michael Perry's latest book.
This is his monologues from the Tint Radio show. And it's called From the Top. And it's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And the cool thing is it's printed on paper that was made in Wisconsin. So this is a true Wisconsin gift.
And to let people, if they're not familiar with Michael Perry, one might almost describe him as a true Wisconsin gift.
He is a true Wisconsin gift. And these are really short pieces, 3 pages at the most. They're perfect to just have sitting around in the kitchen when you're waiting for the stove to be done cooking, or, you know, people are joking about leaving it in the bathroom. But it is, they're funny and to the point stories.
And about 600 to 800 words, and a pretty quick read if you just want to pick one up and flip through it.
Yeah, and it is pure Michael Perry.
And this comes on the heels of an event that you hosted for Michael Perry at the Fireman's Hall in Exonia.
Yeah, and it was so much fun. We had a lot of the EMT and fire workers from Exonia. It was a fundraiser for the fire station there. And what a beautiful building and beautiful place to have it, and a great dance floor too.
So those are the books you brought with you. I'm going to put you on the spot right now, Lisa, and ask you this question. What are you reading right now?
I've got Goldfinch on my pile, and that's the book that I would really most like to have time to read right now. So yeah, look forward to it. But, you know, I tend to be picking up a lot of poetry right now because it's short and it's satisfying.
And this is the busy time of year for you.
It is a busy time of the year.
Well, Lisa Bedoin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Lisa Bedoin owns Books and Company in Oconomowoc. We will have a complete list of the titles she recommended, plus links to more information about each of them at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The last of Lisa's recommendations was Wisconsin writer Michael Perry's latest collection of essays, From the Top. We'll catch up with Michael Perry when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Writer Michael Perry has fans both around these parts and far from his home state of Wisconsin. His past books have told the story of his time as an EMT around the small town of New Auburn, Wisconsin. We've learned about his adventures in raising chickens and 2 daughters, and his friendship with a unique cannon-building neighbor in western Wisconsin. Michael Perry's latest book is a collection of essays, some of which are reminiscent of his work in those earlier books, and all of which are cause to pause and reflect on life in the upper Midwest. The book, called From the Top, was culled from short monologues he included on the syndicated radio show he hosts from the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield and from his regular column in the Wisconsin State Journal. Michael Perry joins us in the studio this morning to catch up on things. Always nice to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
The book that is just out is a collection of essays, thematically diverse ones. And I wanted to start by asking you, you know, you're often a longer form writer than a 2 or 3 page essayist. Obviously, your radio monologues aren't designed to be 10-minute reads. But do you find it, is it liberating or terrifying to try to say something in 800 or 1,000 words?
Well, I wouldn't say it's terrifying because I'm not quite that dramatic, but it's been very challenging because you're right. Most of the stuff I write, I mean, my books are anywhere between 75,000 to 125,000 words. Magazine pieces I do are usually 6,000 to 10,000 words, and even most of my essays are knocking on that territory. Whereas here, these are monologues taken from a weekly radio show that I do, Tent Show Radio, and there's 600 to 800 words, and you have to find some way to put a ribbon on it in 600 or 800 words. So it has been a challenge. It's been one of those nice challenges. It's fun. I say sometimes if you're going to play tennis, you got to put up a net. And here you just have this space, and it's not about your ego or anything like that. It's just a fundamental element of doing show of that nature. You only have so much time.
Well, I would think the nice thing is it's a lot easier to throw out a 600 or an 800 word essay and start over than to say, oh my God, I've gotten 5,000 words into this and I hate it.
Well, yeah, although that part's interesting because the other thing it's taught me, I'm an obsessive revisionist and I just love to sit with a line over and over sometimes for a day and my books are very dense and very polished. And when you're writing a weekly, whether it's a newspaper column, which I do that too, you know, I do a newspaper column for the Wisconsin State Journal, and I do these weekly radio monologues, you do the very best you can. You always try to keep the reader or the listener in mind and keep asking yourself, are they still with me? Is this still funny or heartfelt or interesting? But you have to also finish it and just get on to the next one. And so it's been good for me in the sense that I can't obsess over perfection. You just have to try and tell the story and then start telling another one. So,
but you also write, actually, one of the essays in this book is about being overcommitted to stuff. And that's just one more thing that's keeping you from, I don't know, re-caulking the bathroom.
Yes. And my wife and I have had a couple of family meetings about that this year, collegial and all. But you do have to constantly decide. And in my case, I've gotten in the habit because I've been freelance for over 20 years now. You just never know where your next gig's coming from. Even now, I have a certain amount of uncertainty built into what I do. And so you do get in the habit of never turning down anything and just always working with one eye on the 6 months out. And at this point, I am fortunate enough that I have several opportunities. And you do have to start cutting a few things out here and there. And for me, that's been trying to find a little more time to arrange just solid blocks of extended writing time. I still write every day, but I'm looking for, can I put in 3 weeks without going on the road?
You've written a lot, and we've talked before about your relatively late entry into the world of more popular music.
Yes.
how you really didn't hear much when you were young, and then there's this Waylon Jennings story. So today, in the course of doing this radio show and your work as a musician yourself, you get to rub shoulders with more than a few musicians of renown. How do you see your kids growing up with all this music around them?
It's one of those situations where you want to expose them to things but not shove anything at them. And the example I've been using lately is I was privileged this past year to be allowed to write the liner notes for the new Blind Boys of Alabama album. And part of that came about because they recorded the album in all, of all places, Falkirk, Wisconsin, rural Falkirk, Wisconsin, quite literally a couple of cornfields away from our farm. And over the years, I've known and worked with a guy named Justin Vernon, who went on to, he had a little band called Bon Iver, won a couple of Grammys. Used to be in my band. He'll come crawling back someday, I'm pretty sure. But he, as a result of some of his successes, has been able to build a pretty nice studio out there in the country. And so the Blind Boys came to record there. And it was a cold winter night, and I was able to take my then 12-year-old daughter with me. And we just watched a recording session, and she was able to watch an octogenarian gospel singer from the Deep South singing gospel music in real time, 20 feet away. And she was so moved on the way home, she just said, I'll remember this night for my whole life. And those are the things. I don't expect her to go buy everything that the Blind Boys have recorded. I don't expect her to become an expert on gospel music. But I just hope that, you know, she'll be back checking out Miley and listening to dubstep and explaining dubstep to her father, which she tried to do the other day. But it will be informed by what she saw. I think it's like so many things in life as a parent. You never know if you're doing the right thing, but you do try to expose them to these things, from singer-songwriters to pop to dance, whatever. And then, of course, I play a little guitar, which is really lame. I play guitar with all the nuance of a man cutting brush.
Well, but I wonder if, given your contribution to the Blind Boys of Alabama, their latest CD, I wonder if there's something to the idea that maybe your daughter grows up to be the kind of person that reads the liner notes.
Well, that would be nice. She ought to, because they're paying for her braces. So Yeah, I hope so. Who knows, of course, what liner notes will be in that time. But you do speak to the idea of curiosity. And I think curiosity and – you know, I heard Neil Gaiman say something great one day about kids should be bored. And I agree with him because he talked about how when he was a child, all his most creative thinking came from when he was bored stiff because you were forced to come up with something. And nowadays we're just so desperately afraid of anybody not being completely occupied at all times. And kids especially. And so our poor kids, they get bored sometimes. And they'll say, I'm bored. And we go, oh, that's good. You better figure out something. And it is not necessarily digital. So I hope that she'll just have that curiosity and go looking for things like that, sure. And I think also to see – I love to take her to see shows and see recording, not so she can watch the artist, but so she can watch – look, there's a girl over there who makes her living traveling around the world doing electronics. There's a stagehand. Up at Big Top Chautauqua, you know, the woman who runs the stage, you're watching a professional, a strong woman who makes sure that we're all where we need to be. And so to come to understand the idea that entertainment is not always about the person in the spotlight, but that there are just so many ways to find your way in this world.
But in this collection, you also write that you wouldn't mind if your kids learn to play guitar.
Yeah, because I think – and I can't quote myself exactly, but I've known some women who can play guitar. And generally, women who can play guitar don't take much off you. And I said they don't put up with stuff. And if guy doesn't treat them right, they don't put up with it. And I also say that when they are mistreated by some guy – they write a song about him, and they run him out of town in perpetuity.
Let me ask maybe an indelicate question here. I feel like you've written before about the many things you have read in, and we'll be blunt here, bathrooms.
Yes.
I feel like on some previous edition of the show,
yes,
you quoted the side of a toothpaste.
What it says on the back of the toothpaste right. tube, sure.
Is there some readerly karma in the fact that you have this book that might be fitting just that bill for some people?
I'm happy, man. I've done a lot of reading there. I'd be happy if you did. I don't have any problem talking about it. This is a collection of short pieces. And when I say short, 600 to 800 words is real short. Seems to me to be perfectly suited for that sort of reading. I did see someone just tweeted a picture of the book up in their deer stand. And, you know, in between checking for deer, you maybe can read a quick little essay. So, no, I have no problem with that. I'm just happy to have anybody read me anywhere at any time.
I remember what a revelation it was to find out what that hole was for in the corner of the Farmer's Almanac. The idea that it would be hung up in a place like a
– That's right. It's for the hook. And I'm looking here. I'm just quick checking in the margins here. You could quite easily take this book out to the drill press and sink a hole through it for that hook in the bathroom or the outhouse and not destroy any of the text. So I would – matter of fact, maybe in future we'll start doing that for my book.
We're having this conversation as people are getting into the holiday season. We're talking in fairly early December. Do you have your Christmas tree yet?
I do not, but it's on the list. I'll be doing it either it won't be tonight because it's going to be dark by the time I get home, but we'll do it sometime this week because we always try to do it right after Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Yeah. We should. I guess we'll quickly transition into one of the essays here because it's interesting to think as someone who grew up in rural Wisconsin where trees were plentiful. You were not always a Christmas tree guy.
I was not. And there's a piece in the book, this new book From the Top, and it's called Christmas Tree Kids, and it's about my transition from never having a Christmas tree to now. Looking forward to going out this week and cutting one. Whatever the month, we already have our Christmas tree. It's back behind the pole barn. That's where they all are. I was never a Christmas tree guy. In part, this was due to the counterintuitive fact that I was raised in an obscure Christian church so fundamental the December holiday was viewed as dangerously contrived pagan silliness. So when I was growing up, we never had a Christmas tree in the house. We did get Christmas because my grandma was a believer of a different stripe. She always bought a squat Scotch pine, and some years the pile of presents dwarfed the tree. Later, I left the church and was freed up to get a tree, but by then I was a bachelor and never had reason or interest in dressing or decorating my digs holiday-wise. You know, you got some deer horns and a concert poster on the wall, why mess with the vibe? Plus, based on my housekeeping history, last year's Christmas tree skeleton would still be standing. Also, once, after Grandpa died, I helped Grandma put up her annual Scotch pine, and the whole deal kind of cured me of Christmas trees in general. She had one of those plastic stands with the three screws, and every time I got the tree halfway vertical and tightened one of the screws, the tree would tip over. And just the same as smoke from a campfire always seems to swing around and blow in your face, no matter which screw I was tightening, no matter from what angle, that tree always seemed to manage to fall my way. The needles on a Scotch pine take the term needles very seriously, and by the time I got that blankety-blank tree to stand upright, I felt like I'd been loofed with an overactive porcupine. Oh, and the language, profoundly un-Christmassy. Anyways, for years, I didn't have a Christmas tree. Then I got married, and my wife brought with her a beautiful young girl named Amy, who's now my daughter. To my eternal shame, when our first Christmas rolled around, I still held out. We did decorate the house, but I didn't think we needed a tree. Plus, we were going to visit Grandma. But then we moved to a farm, and there were Christmas trees growing right out back. So the second week of December, we went ahead and cut one. I was reluctant, but Amy's eyes lit right up. She helped me saw it down, drag it in, and put it up. And now come the day after Thanksgiving, I'm the first one lobbying to grab the saw and get out there. We cut last year's tree out on the ridge, Amy taking her turn on the bucksaw, while Jane, our youngest, played in the snow with our black cat. We hauled the tree and the little one back home in a sled. Halfway down the trail, I took a picture of Annalisa and the girls and the tree. In the photo, all three of them are looking at me with blue eyes and smiles, the tree settled on the sled between them. We brought the tree inside and spent the evening stringing popcorn beside the fire and letting the girls take turns hanging ornaments. Later, when Annalisa was putting Jane to bed, I was in the kitchen doing dishes when I noticed the living room lights go out. I looked, and there was Amy sitting sideways in the old overstuffed chair, legs dangling, staring at the lit tree in the dark. You want, in moments like these, to just shut the world down and call it a day. And when I pulled that dishwater drain, that's exactly what I did. Went in and sat with her. That tree was a spruce, short and a tad gappy, although nowhere near Charlie Brown status. But it looked perfectly beautiful glowing in the corner that evening. I got to thinking about how long I'd held out against getting a Christmas tree and how the kids coming along changed things and what lesson I might take from that. And I believe those first Christmas trees taught me that sometimes you need to stop being the man you think you are and start being the man you ought to be. Merry Christmas.
Michael Perry reading his essay, Christmas Tree Kids, from his new collection, From the Top. Well, we are glad, as always, to have you here and come back and see us again. Mike Perry, thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Perry's latest book is called From the Top, Brief Transmissions from Tent Show Radio, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. He lives in rural western Wisconsin and stopped by after a recent reading at the Fireman's Hall in Exonia. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, why doctors should pay more attention to sepsis. And we'll learn about the little-known Milwaukeean who gave rise to a baseball tradition, souvenirs and novelties. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.